Is it a dumb game, or am I just dumb?
What's dropping?
If you are looking for relevant gaming coverage from experts, you are not getting it on this show.
How do you know you're getting old?
Facebook paid $19 billion for a social media thing, an app, and I've never heard of it. Ever. $19 billion. A number we can't even fathom. And I found out today can't even be typed into my phone's calculator.
A number so large. No man can fathom it. No computer can calculate it.
Paid for something I've never heard of. Meanwhile, I pass by in the same city that Facebook calls home, like 5 to 10 homeless people a day. There's these two guys in particular. I've referenced them before on the podcast. Clearly drug addicts. I see them at least twice a day. The other day, someone, I think from the Salvation Army, came by and gave them hats and coats, and I think they might have even gotten a shower out of the deal.
Like a shower on the street?
I think they have a facility they probably take them into and fix them up, you know?
I thought you were witnessing a shower, like, right then and there.
They just, like, take out a fire hose.
Saddle up, gents. Take a drink from the hose.
Put cowboy hats on them. So these dudes get hats, coats, a shower. They've been riding high for a fucking week solid. Like, these guys have grins ear to ear.
That's awesome.
So this country, and San Francisco more particularly, have beaten these guys down to the point where, like, a hand-me-down Tampa Bay Buccaneers starter jacket significantly alters their standard of living. Meanwhile, 20 feet away, like, in an intersection that they're right by, without fail, every day, some dickhead is just laying on his horn, you know, fresh off his job at Facebook, laying on the horn of his Mini Cooper because he didn't make it through a yellow light or some shit. And you know, like, he goes home and just gives it to his wife about this. Like, every day she's got to listen to this guy gripe about how awful his life is because he didn't quite make it through that yellow.
Right.
But by the way, the total cost of transforming those homeless dudes' lives wasn't $19 billion. I'm estimating it at about $3.
You know, I don't know if you've heard about this because it happens in your city in particular, but there's a program in the city where they'll give food away to homeless folks in these, like, shopping bags and stuff. And people in your town who are not homeless, who don't need the stuff, will go out, they'll get a bag, they'll sell the contents of the bag because it's like canned goods and shit like that. And then they'll get back in line wearing different outfits to get another bag, and they'll sell the contents of that. Therefore, they take food out of the mouths of the homeless so that they can profit. I've seen it on video. It's crazy. Your city is out of control when it comes to the inequities that people face and how they actually face them. It's nuts.
I mean, I can't get over this notion that I saw this $3 expenditure have such an effect on these two guys.
Right.
And meanwhile, you multiply that by $6
billion. Yeah.
And that's what Facebook paid for a messaging service. Like,
I don't even know what WhatsApp is or WhatsApp. I don't know what it is. I just see it in my Google feed, and I don't care. I see that large of a number, and I think, to me, it sounds like money wasted, but I don't know shit about dick when it comes to these investments. I don't know.
Let me break it down for you. It's like CompuServe spending the GDP of Jamaica on ICQ in 1997. That's what's just happened. Like, at this point, the custodian at WhatsApp is the guy who wipes down their Herman Miller Aeron chairs. He's going to be blowing $300 a week on CrossFit. And probably dumping his 40K salary into calf implants, like, on a monthly basis. It's like, at what point do we say, you know what, Facebook, we're good with text messaging. You know, we've got Twitter, Snapchat, AOL, Digsby, Trillion, Facebook Messenger, and about 500 other services. So, you know, we're fine on that. Instead, here's an idea. Could you just, like, spend that $19 billion so our entire country could go to college for free? Or, you know what? Here's another idea. How about you take $20 million, just a little slice of that, you won't even notice it, and completely overhaul the entire public transit system of the city? Or how about just a few grand a week and feed all the homeless in the city for the next fucking millennia?
Or even something as simple as, how about just bail out Nintendo in this time of crisis? Because we need we need Nintendo to be back on top so they can be producing great games. I don't know. I mean, I get pissed about this kind of stuff, too. And in my line of work, I see a lot of dollars wasted. And sometimes I am part of that. I'm just a cog in the machine, and it's very frustrating. But what I can say, at least for myself, is I try my best at work and outside of work to be cognizant of those types of expenditures. So when I'm at work, I make sure that, you know, if I have to do some kind of contracting action or whatever it is, that it follows a certain set of principles. In other words, it doesn't violate my personal ethos that you don't waste taxpayer dollars, right? Now, in my personal life, I also try to be, I don't know what the word is. I try to be a very benevolent middle classer and help out with charities and whatnot. But full disclosure, I do not give the homeless shit. I see those motherfuckers and I'm like, get out of my face. I got shit to do, you nincompoop fucking poop.
Yeah, I give homeless people stuff, but I don't even know how I do it, what the system is, what the judgment is. And I feel guilty all the time. It's like, because I'm in my head is this $19 billion. I'm like, like, here I am on the street feeling guilty about you. I want to help you, but I don't have $19 billion that could change everything.
Yeah, I wish I practiced more of what I preach when it comes to that stuff. And I wish I had that kind of heart where I could approach a homeless person and not be so cynical as to say, well, they're going to spend this on drugs. Or I guess I wish I were a nicer human being. But the reality is I have a cold heart, Tanner. I have a really cold heart. I hate people. And I especially hate poor people. They just annoy me.
Well, so this is never going to happen. Facebook, I mean, it's just, they're just trying to make a few select people some money. So it's, you know, what's our consolation prize? Well, people still die on the street. Kids are going to starve. We'll go bankrupt because of school credit or medical debt or whatever.
Yeah.
But we'll still have two things.
A great app on our phone.
Yes. And number two, fucking video games.
That's right. Oh, boy.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Super Dumb Games, episode 21. I'm one of your hosts, Tanner.
I am your other host, Chris.
What have you been playing this week, Chris?
The question isn't what have I been playing. The question is what have I fumbled that one up. What have I not been playing? I played so much Nintendo this week. And I'm happy.
What?
Yeah. Oh my God.
As in Nintendo Entertainment System?
Yes. Yeah. Like Nintendo Entertainment System. So let me start off. I don't know if you ever played the Nintendo game Muscle. That's M.U.S.C.L.E, all caps.
I have not, but I played with the figures, of course, and I had a poster on my wall detailing all of them.
Yes, Muscle Men, the figurines themselves, that brings back great memories. God, we used to have Muscle Men wrestling matches on the stoop at our good friend of the show, Eric's house. And then I think we would like race cars off the side of it, and somehow it dictated which muscle man you would get to choose. And then we would throw the muscle men at a hockey net and see which ones stuck in the net. And those were like the survivors. Those were the gilded members of our like the ones that fell. They were the horrible muscle men.
What I really love about Muscle Man or Muscle Men is, it looks like a half-finished product.
Yeah, it's all pink and disgusting.
It looks like a test mold.
Yeah.
And they were just like, yeah, just like they ran out of money or
yeah.
something.
We also used to, this is how dumb we were, but this is what kids do. Like we've discussed before, you just play with shit. We would put them on George and Eric's garage, which was, it wasn't an automatic garage. You would have to close it yourself. we would raise the garage up and place the muscle men in little divots in the garage, and then lower the garage slowly until it reached almost full vert, like 90 degrees from the ground, to see who could cling on the longest. We had an obsession with how muscle men clinged to shit. I don't know. So I played that game. It's actually a really horrible wrestling game. It's not very fun at all. I thought I was going to have a great time playing it, and I did not. So from there, I moved on to SCAT, which stands for Special Cybernetic Attack Team.
You're all about the acronymed NES games this week.
Well, in those two cases, for sure. Listen, I'm going to throw out a very risky recommendation here. I think you should play SCAT. It's a side-scrolling shooter, so it's sort of like if you ever played Vanguard for Atari or Gradius or R-Type at the arcades. You know, you get your power-ups, you get special weapons, you've got like a shield around you, and it's interesting because you can switch the shield to different sides of your character as you're scrolling. Also, it's not a simple side-scroller. You, at one point, like, you'll reach an end to the screen, and then you have to scroll up and shoot stuff, and then you reach another level, and then you move over to the side, that kind of thing. So it's very interesting. But here's the thing about that game. It's fucking brutal. You only get one life. That's it. One life,
God.
And the game is over.
That game should come packed with a game genie.
I mean, seriously, it's the Dark Souls of 1988. It's just, it's incredible.
You should double impact it.
I will. I mean, the thing is we might only get one or two videos out of it because, I mean, I can't play that game for 18 minutes. I'm dead within five, so. But I loved it. I'm going to recommend it. People, if you have a chance to either get it on an emulator, if you find it at the flea shop or whatever that's called, flea mart. What is that called? What are those called? Flea market. There it is. You know, pick it up. Third game I played, hit game called Baby Boomer. Have you ever heard of this game, Tanner?
No.
It's
how are you finding these games?
I own them. So Baby Boomer, it was designed for the light gun. So it was released in 89 exclusively to North America. It did have
never a good sign when a Nintendo game is designed for one of their cash grab peripherals.
Yeah, exactly. Japan wouldn't have it. They didn't want anything to do with this shit.
The big tanker like pulled into port, and there's just like a dude just waving them back, and they just back up.
It's literally that's what happens in Shenmue when you work in the port on Shenmue. You're trying to offload crates of Baby Boomer cards.
This guy looking at a clipboard like, nope, just nope. Crosses it out. Tanker pulls back, comes back to port, buries all the carts in the desert.
So Baby Boomer, terrible, terrible game. Premise of the game is this baby is on a deadly crawl towards danger. And he ain't stopping. That's the thing. The baby is always crawling forward. There's nothing impeding his forward progress except for you and the obstacles that are in his way. And you have to clear those obstacles with the light gun. So as he's coming up on a bottomless pit, you'll have to shoot a cloud. The cloud will zap down ice that forms an ice bridge. Baby Boomer gets across the pit safely. But then, out of nowhere, check out his six, because here comes a kitty cat right on his ass. He might get Baby Boomer. And then, you know, if one of these obstacles gets in his way and hits him, that's it. You also have different level environments. I didn't make it very far in them, but there's graveyards. Also one called the Pearly Gates of Heaven and the Pits of Hell. I did not make it to either of those. They sound amazing.
I liked this game better 5 years later when it was a movie called Baby's Day Out.
The inspiration for a classic. So before we get to yours, I just wanted to talk about sort of it's something that I got bored with playing certain Nintendo games after a while. So I devised a challenge for myself, and that challenge was this. Any listeners out there who want to take the challenge and try to beat my scores, I welcome that. The challenge was this. I booted up different baseball games for the Nintendo Entertainment System. One of them was a game I'm very familiar with. The other two games I had never actually played before, at least not in my memory. And so what I was trying to do was tally up, like, what's the difficulty? Are they shitty? You know, that kind of a thing. Or are they just dumb? So I began with the classic RBI Baseball 3, played as Detroit, of course, lost 10-9. It's a great game. The mechanics, when you crush a ball out of the park, it feels like you're crushing that ball. It's just, it's got a perfect feel. Like, you feel the sweet spot. I lost in one game. So the game's difficulty, in my opinion, is hard. I should win every game. So I moved on from there. I only did one game a piece for each of these games. Next game was Bad News Baseball. In my notes to that, I wrote, home run fest. Sparky was player of the game. This game has the best music ever. 1-10-2. I can't even tell you what the music was, but for some reason I wrote this game has the best music ever. So I will be checking out Bad News Baseball again just to check out the music. And the third game and the final one, because I want to try to save this for more baseball games. I'll give updates maybe over the next few months as I play more. But the other one was Baseball Stars. And my notes for that one read, incomprehensible team logos. So I ended up being the Warriors facing off against the Stars, which just had a Japanese flag for a logo. Stances are either the Mickey Tettleton or Julio Franco. Lost 11-0. That was it. If you know Mickey Tettleton and Julio Franco, you will know the stances I'm talking about. So that's what I played this week. Tanner, what did you play?
I didn't play any dumb games this week. I continued playing Spelunky, which I'm still going to rave about. Incredible game. Highly recommended. It is the most frustrating, awful, wonderful game in the world.
Didn't they just come out with like a Metroid DLC or something for that game?
I didn't hear about it if they did.
Hmm. Or maybe I'm thinking of Spelunker or whatever. I don't know.
And the other game I played was the Last of Us DLC Left Behind. Oh my God, that game is... I can't, like, I'm dying to... I just want to talk to people about it. I don't... Like, what? I want to walk around on the streets and just grab people, like, by their cuffs and shake them, by their lapels and shake them and talk to people about it. I'm obsessed with the game. I think it's the most, like, interesting, well-done, bold, emotionally impactful, awesome thing. It's clearly... Like, the DLC, like, the game was amazing, and then the DLC is as amazing as the game, if not even more amazing, and it's clearly in my top 5 games of this generation of consoles, and I think it might even be in my top 10 games of all time. That's how good I think this game is. And it's one of those games where you can't talk about it because the spoilers ruin everything. You know, it's a game you just don't want to know what happens, because those moments when they hit, unlike it feels like every other game in existence, these moments hit like they should hit, and they feel earned, and they feel elegantly done and written with expertise. And I was watching the documentary about the making of this game, which is free on Amazon now. Don't watch it if you haven't played it.
Oh, okay, good. I was gonna watch it.
Yeah, and I don't. Yeah.
All right.
But it gives you a behind the scenes look on how they record the voice acting and the scenes, and you can see that sure they get talented voice actors and they have a good guy in charge of stuff, but they've come up with a technical system in which they just get actors in a fucking room together instead of in booths. And they try to simulate the physical space, and they have them run through the scenes. And then the animators look at their faces, mm-hmm. and animate to their faces. And it makes all the difference. Like, this, everyone made a big deal out of that capture in L.A. Noire, but it almost seems like what they're doing at Naughty Dog, the idea of capturing actors in a physical space and then trying to model that in real life is so much more profound. It's so much more affecting that... There's been moments throughout that series and in the DLC that I'm welling up. I'm invested. I give a shit about these characters. I think Ellie in Last of Us is one of the greatest video game characters of all time. Full stop. It's an incredible series. It's wonderful.
With regard to the, in terms of how they recorded the characters, I didn't realize they did that, but I did. I was recently reading an interview with a voice actor, and I can't remember who it was. They're famous. They do voice acting and a ton of shit. And what they said in their experience, for them, like, their worst experience when it comes to doing voice acting is when it's just you in the booth with the headphones and you're reading the same line and they go, okay, do it again. Do it again. This time, try it this way. And their best experience was always when they got to feed off of what was going on with the other actors. They actually had somebody else there in the scene with them. And that's where they felt they got the best product. So maybe that's, I mean, in part, not just the writing, but also that fact that they fuse these people together in the room and force them to have these encounters together.
It's so clear when you watch the documentary that has a huge effect, because you see the actors really looking. I mean, acting, I've heard, acting is listening in a lot of ways. And you can't really listen unless you're there with the person. Because communication is 50% like, you know, gestural.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've learned about OkCupid and why it fails.
Dating update.
I do want to tell you, though, and for any people who want to learn more about what's going on in The Last of Us and Last of Us Left Behind, right now, if you ever go to reddit.com, there is an Ask Me Anything with Neil Druckmann, who's the creative director, and Bruce Straley, the game director. It's going on right now. That means nothing to you when you hear this podcast, but search the archives of the AMA Ask Me Anything subreddit, and you will see where they discuss such things as the relationship between Joel and Ellie and what motivated them to write the characters the way they did. And they don't spoil anything when they said it. They just said, they said basically when it comes to writing the scenes, they found that the characters wrote themselves. And I think that's what happens when you have solid characters. That's just the reality of writing. When you have good characters, the scenes build around their personality and everything else. It's not an artificial construct. We know that because we're good writers.
One quick thing. The Dark Souls stream cannot happen on the 14th. I will, in fact, be in D.C. So what I'm planning is sometime during the week or the weekend, starting on the 21st, I actually would like, you know, people who actually, you know who you are, that visit the streams, let me know via email or Twitter or whatever what times are best for you for the streams, and I'll try to tailor it to that schedule so we actually, you know, it's much more fun when other people participate. Of course, let me know. It would have to be sometime on the 21st, 22nd, or 23rd. So let me know what's convenient for you.
All right. Well, before we go into the next segment, I just want to say, you know, playing all these dumb old NES games for the past few weeks, it really got me nostalgic. And that's not anything new. I'm always nostalgic about stuff, but not necessarily for any specific game or an era of gaming in particular for my life. But I started to remember how with some games, there became this built-in air of mystery surrounding how they're played, or more importantly, how well they can be played, or different ways gamers have manipulated a video game that defies the laws of the fucking universe, or sometimes just simply how there would be this mythos built up around a game where you had a friend of a friend of a friend who swore that he had a friend of a friend who claims that they shot the dog in Duck Hunt. And these urban legends would build up around these games. So as we're heading into the news, Tanner, I want you to kind of think about these gaming urban legends that maybe manifested themselves in your life or within our circles of friends, but also how sometimes those urban legends weaved a yarn so fantastic and downright impossible, we actually wish that we could believe them. But first, the news. Pulling the old John Kerry flip-flop on you, ladies and gentlemen. This week, it will be I, Chris, the one true game master of this podcast, bringing you the world's hottest video game news. What's dropping? Tanner, Rambo, the video game, released February 21st, much to the dismay of Brian Dennehy and all of Afghanistan and Vietnam. Rambo, the video game, puts the player in John Rambo's combat boots and takes them on an action-packed journey through the iconic combat sequences and story arcs of First Blood, trademark, Rambo First Blood Part 2, also trademark, and Rambo 3, again, trademark.
This, call me crazy, this feels a little bit late.
You're probably right about that, but for true fans of the Rambo series, this came at just the right time. I mean, the last time I saw a Rambo movie was in the theater, and it was just titled Rambo, and that was like 2007, I think. And it was that shitty, it was the shitty one that was booted up with Sylvester Stallone looking all of 50 years old. You know,
And so my gut reaction, knowing a little bit about game development, is that this game might have intended to be released alongside that movie, was a disaster, probably got tossed around a few times, and then just shat out by whoever these no-name publishers and developers are.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about this game, because I think you're going to get more excited about it. The developer is Tevon. That might just be a dude. I don't know.
It sounds like...
I think it's a dude living in Baltimore, Maryland right now, just hanging out.
I think he opened for En Vogue in 1998.
The publisher is Reef Entertainment, and they are not pulling any punches with this shit. I mean, you get full English interface, full audio in English, full subtitles in English. And if you want, you don't get full audio in the rest of these, but you get interface and subtitles in French, Italian, German, and Spanish. They took the time to translate some shit. Locked and loaded with the trademark Rambo arsenal of weapons, you battle through the boss showdowns and takedowns from the films. Everything from Rambo's evading the police in First Blood to his single explosive bow strike on Lieutenant Tay in Rambo First Blood Part 2, and onto his shredding Russian helicopters with the DSHK 12.7mm heavy machine gun in Rambo 3.
So it's like a greatest hits of Rambo's best kills or something.
Here's the worst part about the game. Before I go into acting like I think this game is good, it's a rail shooter, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, where, like, no.
Yeah, so it's not an open world explosive, you know, like, hey, I'm gonna just blow shit up and find a camp somewhere and tread lightly and then pick a guy off with an arrow when I emerge from the water, just, you know, glistening with wetness and stuff. That doesn't happen. You are on a guided path from point A to the end of the story.
That is
this game. But hey, look, you got 16 missions of action based on the movie series, all out action in rail shooting face-offs. Players will need to make tactical use of cover options to survive enemy onslaught. I think I did that in Virtua Cop for the Sega Saturn. Features actual voices of Rambo and Colonel Troutman from the motion pictures. Let me rephrase that. It does not actually feature Sly Stallone or the guy who played Colonel Troutman, I can't think of his name now, doing voice acting. I think they just took clips from the movies. they licensed them.
Some guy held up like a hand recorder to a CRT television playing a VHS copy of First Blood.
Yeah.
I feel like there was a short window that we could tolerate rail shooters, maybe 91 to 96, but post that, I mean,
you're right,
it's just not a genre that should exist anymore, I feel.
But maybe I can sell you on a few more points, because I understand that that's a bit prohibitive. As a player, you want more out of your game, but listen to this, dude. Selected music from the motion picture soundtracks. All right, so that means they took like track one off of Rambo or First Blood. They took like track eight, the ones that were the cheapest to buy, I'm guessing.
Yeah. There was a spreadsheet. They got all the songs and then just sorted it by price and just bought the top of the first five.
Yeah. 25 different enemy types. So it ranges from Mujahideen Afghani to Taliban Afghani,
to other North, brown people,
to Viet Cong, to South Vietnamese, to
anyone,
police officer.
Anyone that's not white.
15 different guns plus a range of different arrow tips for Rambo's bow.
And
three difficulty levels. Go on, yes.
Never before. I mean, the big selling point for this game, I saw the box copy at my local Babbage's. It said never before has a player avatar looked this much like a penis. Because Sly Stallone, of any actor, can you think of another actor that looks more like a penis than Sly Stallone?
I'm trying to think. I mean, there are penis faces out there, but actually, when I encounter penis heads, penis faces, whatever they, it depends on the structure of their entire skull or if it's just the face itself and how it's positioned on the skull. But I encounter them mostly in my real life, not so much in the cinema. So I would say Sly Stallone is a top contender for penis face.
And not only face, but his whole body is like a penis. I think Daniel Craig is like a second runner up for penis face, but his body is less penis like.
Three difficulty levels with corresponding score multiplier bonuses. Play on Green Beret for highest scoring potential. Yes, this is the ultimate Rambo experience. Now, Tanner, here's the thing. I did some research. The reviews are in. How well do you think this game fared against the critics?
So what am I going by, percentage?
Let's do a scale of like 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best. Where do you think the average is putting this, roughly?
So you got to factor in that game criticism has a very high average. Like if you look on Metacritic,
right,
shit games will still score in the 70s.
Which is crazy, and I think it's been identified even within the community of gamers. I think we've all sort of identified the culprits who are doing this, like that games are inflated. It used to be games could get a 1, and it made sense why they would, but now like a 7 means it might as well be a 1, don't play it, and like an 8 is a mediocre game, and then 9 to 10 is like the cream of the crop. But anyway, go on.
I'm going to say... So do I have to give a point number in a way, like a 6.7?
No, you can just round
to
a whole number.
I'm going to put it in the fives, 5.
Look at you. Look at you. Congratulations. I'll just read the 4 critics that I found valid anyway, because there's some gaming sites, not ours, certainly, that I would never, I would never cite them for their reviews. But Eurogamer, 5 out of 10. Edge Online, I don't really read them, but 5 out of 10. This one was interesting, though, and I don't really care for IGN, but this is what they said. 3.0, calling it, quote, awful. Your worst nightmare. The reviewer claims he killed, this is what he says, I'm serious, in his article, 147 people in the first 8 minutes of gameplay. I think that's so
That
awesome.
Reminds me of Hot Shots. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah. Oh, yes,
when they
of
have
course.
The kill counter and he's Rambo.
and you spoke of Metacritic, so to wrap this up with Rambo, Metacritic has this game, and I think it's only at this point, it's because it just came out, there's 11 reviews in, but Metacritic has this at a 41. And even more astonishingly, though, the user score, which is, I think, usually much higher than what the critics give. So if a game is a 7 out of 10, the users who rate the games on Metacritic will say, like, 10 out of 10, I loved it, even if it's in reality like an 8 out of 10. The user score right now, as I speak, holds firm at 3.0.
I may have to play this game. Is it out on PlayStation 3?
It's let's see. It's available on it's definitely on Steam. Why can't I figure this out right now? It's on Win XP Vista 7.8 blah blah blah. It looks like it's only on the PC.
Damn it!
Yeah, that's unfortunate, ladies and gentlemen. That is what's dropping this thing. So I hope you enjoy it. Moving on to top sizzlers. Tanner, this first story comes to us from GameSpot.com. I know that that's maybe a bit taboo for our podcast to cite such a notable source.
Reputable source. The Super Dumb Games news team. Their bookmark list is just ugly.
But I think that there's something to be discussed here. So, headline. One of Shadow of Mordor's most ambitious features scaled back for Xbox 360, PS3. Here's the story. Design director Michael DePlater, I think that's how you say his name, he's with Monolith Gaming, he announced that it is impossible for them to replicate the gaming experience players who own next-gen consoles will experience on the PS3 or Xbox 360 because it's just too goddamn complex with this so-called Nemesis system that the new, you know, the Xbox One and PS4 can handle. In other words, if you still live in the Stone Age and have the paperweights formerly known as the Xbox 360 and PS3, you're fucked. Now, Tanner, I'm sure... Well, actually, I'm not sure if you're aware of what this so-called Nemesis system is. Do you need me to explain it to you?
Yeah, I haven't heard of this.
Okay. Essentially, it's this... it's a complex gaming feature that the next-gen consoles can handle, like I said. I mean, they can spit this shit out, wipe their asses with it. They don't care because they have the power to run it. But its function within the game is to allow things like, for instance, with this game, Middle Earth, Shadow of Mordor, it could allow the game to imprint unique faces and personalities on every NPC within the game. But more importantly, it also allows those same NPCs to essentially live their lives when they're off screen, without you having to even be there. So, again, in other words, computers have become fucking sentient. Skynet is confirmed. LA will get nuked by Terminators on August 29th, 1997, and there ain't shit we can do about it. But let me tell you about...
This sounds like a developer who is, like, way overestimating what his game really is. To me.
Let me give you a quote from the developer then. This is what they say it can do. The Nemesis system for Shadow of Mordor, this is a quote again, allows every enemy that players face to be a unique individual with their own personality as well as strengths and weaknesses. These enemies will continue to do their tasks when off screen and can even grow in rank and esteem when players meet them again. I'm adding this later in the game. If a player chooses not to kill an enemy, the enemy will learn from the experience and grow stronger. So, that's the end of the quote. If I'm understanding this correctly, you'd basically be doing your quests and shit, but as you adventure, you'll encounter NPCs whose lives you'll be affecting, you know, either, I guess, first and foremost, by either not killing them or killing them. I don't know. But let's say you let one live. When you encounter them next time, let's say 20 levels later, they'll be a changed person, not just because you let them live or whatever dialogue you had with them, but also apparently they might be having off-screen interactions on their own while you're off in the world doing other shit.
Yeah, this is, I guess, the big promise of this next generation is this AI processing. And it has been said that these new consoles are going to be much more capable of running a bunch of processes at one time. The thing is, they're still releasing this game for the older consoles, right? I mean...
That brings me to... When I read the story, this is what clicked in my head. You know, I still own... I called them paperweights in jest, but I still own a PS3, and I will buy games for it for the time being because I feel like games should still be in development, especially, I think, at the tail end of any console. That's... A lot of time, that's when the best games come out because games are optimized at their, you know, it's at their best at the end of the life of the console. You know, when things are right at the beginning, they don't really know how to utilize all the resources, but at the end, they know exactly how to tap into everything the PS3 can do. In this case, though, they're saying to us, hey, look, we have this, this system. I can't even remember what I called it, the Nexus or whatever it is, Nemesis. We can't replicate it on the older systems. So guess what? We're going to try to We're going to still try to give you the experience of playing this game, but it won't be the same experience you get on the next-gen consoles. And it got me pissed because I'm thinking, in my life, I think that there has been other games that were released that utterly failed to deliver on their promises. And the point of this story for me wasn't that, you know, they kind of shrugged their shoulders. It's more like they first intended to be able to port them on all four systems. Then they said, shit, we can't do it. They pulled the rug out from people who would want to play this game possibly. And now they're left high and dry. They're going to play a subpar game. So I'm wondering, can you remember a game in your past where, you know, it was touted to deliver X, Y, and Z, and then when you played it, it was utterly reprehensible to you?
X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, I think, was this game that I was heavy into Star Wars Roleplay Online, and I was playing a lot of TIE Fighter and all of that, and then heard the pitch for X-Wing versus TIE Fighter and was thinking, this is what I've always wanted. And I remember me and my role-playing buddies all talking about, we'll just do all our role-playing on X-Wing versus TIE Fighter.
Oh, yeah.
And I pre-ordered it. It came. It got shipped to my house. I opened it up, installed it in my computer, and then, like, fired up my 56K dial-up modem and my shit Packard Bell computer, and the game is just chugging along. And it was like I had imagined this world that only I think now we can realize, but back then it always seemed like it was just, we were almost there. Developers would speak as if we had already gotten there, but the technology did not quite caught up with the ambition. I think at this point we're at the point where those two things meet, but with X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, it didn't. I barely played the game.
See, I played that game. I think that was my first introduction to ladder matches. If you remember, there was a whole ladder system where you would go through and try to compete. And I was really good with the A-Wing, but I think it was because it didn't take as many resources on my PC, honestly. Like, for some reason, it rendered the graphics differently. I don't know. But, I mean, that was a truly unbearable game. I was actually thinking of, because we're both MMO fans, there was a game that was called Horizons. And it was pitched in the early 2000s. I think it was supposed to be released in 2003. Again, it was like the answer to the things that weren't in EverQuest. They weren't in Dark Age of Camelot or whatever. Their pitch was, you would get like 20 different races, 50 classes, a zoneless world, which was huge back then, and then they would have world events that would continually alter the landscape of the world itself. And that game was eventually released. It followed up on none of its promises. I didn't play it because I saw through the ruse that they were putting up. I mean, it was impossible back then, but they were trying to act again like technology had caught up with what they could achieve. Ultimately, that game was renamed Astaria Chronicles of the Gifted, and as far as I know, no one in the fucking world wasted their time with it. So
I'm a huge MMO guy. I don't even remember that game.
It was one of those stories where, like, you read it and you were like, oh my god, this is the answer. Especially for me, I think I've always told you that one of my big things is I always wanted world events. I wanted it to be a situation where even if you're level one, you might encounter a world event that alters fundamentally the shape of the world, like a Frodo Baggins moment. And that's what this game was trying to promise. But it also promised like dragons as a race, which was stupid because it was like dragons, angels, elves, dark elves, lizards. I mean, it had so much bullshit tacked to it.
I'm not even sure that should be our goal with MMOs, the whole world-changing stuff. That's always been the holy grail of MMOs. When I think back to the best moments in MMOs, it's just crazy shit that happens with you and your buds, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I think I'm glorifying the product experience and not the user experience. The user experience is it's you and your buds. The product experience is what content are they throwing in your face. Yeah. And there's a part of me that really wishes that the product experience would be on par with the user experience. our second top sizzler. This one comes as no surprise to you, Tanner, because I think we talked about this earlier this week. Ken Levine, a co-founder of Irrational Games, responsible for such hits as Bioshock, Bioshock Infinite, and System Shock 2, announced in a rather bizarre editorial posted to the website that he's happy the, quote, incredible team they've built over the last 17 years has produced fantastic products, but you're all fired so I can get my game developer dick wet without you. P.S. Thanks for the billions of dollars you made me.
Cue squealing tires.
Yeah. I mean, he effectively both fired people in one paragraph and then gleefully announced that while they're all fucked, I'm moving on to doing other shit that I love to do, which is apparently, according to him in the blog entry, was he wants to do narrative-driven games for the core gamer that are highly replayable, whatever that means.
I could talk for the next 20 minutes about this shit, but I'll try not to.
Okay.
So when I first heard this story, I was running hot.
You sent me a message straight away.
I was on fire. Like, I was just pissed the fuck off because, you know, 120 people, including one of my favorite podcast personalities, games journalists from back in the day, Sean Elliott, was one of the people who got laid off. So I was really pissed because I hate what this is happening all the time in game development, where just shitloads of people get laid off on the regular, like it's no big deal. And it's particularly infuriating this instance because that game was a massive fucking hit and success. Mm-hmm. And in no other industry do you release some hit product and then all of a sudden the people who made that product are without jobs or something.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about this. The big thing that's the huge dick move, and Chris, you called this out, was the fact that he combined the announcement of 100-some people's lives being destroyed and thrown into, you know, pure upheaval. He combined that with the announcement of his new project in the same breath.
Yeah. And what? That's a horrible
thing. It's horrible. And what? It's so narcissistic, egotistical, whatever. So what ended up happening was all of the news was about what's Ken Levine doing next? Mm-hmm. And it's like, meanwhile, there's people. Sean Elliott, this amazing, awesome dude. Everyone should follow him on Twitter. He's funny as fuck. He tweeted the same day he found out he was getting laid off. Apparently, Ken Levine's message was the announcement to them.
Wow.
That same day, he found out he was having a boy. Like,
oh my God.
And it brings home the reality that there's 100-some people that were depending on this studio. They made a hit game. They worked their asses off for like 4 to 5 years, delivered a hit game, and now they're done with.
Right. Well, I mean, in case people don't know what the life of a shit-tier schlub working at a game developer, and I'm not calling the guy that you were talking about I'm talking about like the grunts who are, you know, in the trenches. I mean, their lives are shitty. You're working 100 plus hour weeks. When the projects are done, you are usually fired or you know what I mean, like a lot of guys just end up getting let go. The point is, for me, like, he just sent a bunch of people to the unemployment lines and then basically broke up with them via a blog post.
Well, you know? Here's the thing. So I've been thinking about this. We don't know why the studio got closed. I mean, my knee-jerk reaction initially was, you know, fuck him. He's closing the studio to follow his little dream, you know, to be like an indie developer or whatever. But it's just as likely that Take-Two, the company that owns this developer, Irrational, said, you're fucked. We want to close you. What are you going to do? We still want you, Ken. And he's like, well, I'll create a small team. That's very plausible. That doesn't erase the fact that it's super shitty to announce everyone's being laid off and then to shine the spotlight back on yourself. That's fucked.
Yeah. One blog entry for the people who, like, pour one out for the people who are gone. 5 days later, talk about how, okay, well, I think this is how we're going to rise up from this this event. That, I don't know. I think that everything that he did was shitty. I think it's reprehensible, honestly. It doesn't give me any... there's no love lost between myself and Ken Levine or Levine or whatever. I don't know how you say his fucking name.
Yeah, and it's so weird for me because I was such a huge Bioshock fan. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of my favorite games of all time. And then, you know, this happens regularly in life where you're like, oh, this is amazing. Whoever made this is great. And then you learn more about them. You consume more of their stuff. And you're like, maybe that was just kind of like, you know, a right time, right place kind of thing. The other really interesting wrinkle to this is Gone Home, my game of the year for last year. That was made by people, four people, at least one of them, I think maybe two of them, maybe all of them, but one for sure, were developers at Irrational making Bioshock Infinite, and they said, fuck this. And they left in the middle of development, moved to Portland, started this small studio, and were like, we're going to make a game that fucking matters and isn't racist as fuck. I'm projecting that on them. And they made Gone Home, and now Ken Levine is basically saying, oh, I want to make stuff like Gone Home.
Yeah, that's how ironic that that happened, honestly. That's incredible. Well, we could talk about this for hours, because you and I both have our feelings about labor and whatnot, but our final story actually kind of connects with the first story where I ended with the MMO situation, and you talked about the gamer experience, you know, the user experience versus what the product gives you. And our final story is, and I guess this is with a bit of sadness I say this, because I've been tracking it for the past, well, I should say our Croc news team has been, I didn't say crack, our Croc news team has been tracking this for the last 20 hours or so. With just 15 hours left to go at the time of this recording, Pantheon Rise of the Fallen is short of their goal of raising $800,000 on Kickstarter. And just to give you an idea, when I first looked up this story, they had 19 hours to go, and all they've made in the last 4 hours is $2,500, basically, toward their goal. And they, yeah, and the thing is that they have until, I think it's tomorrow at, like, when is it? Oh, they've got 16 hours to go right now. And, you know, look, we discussed this a few episodes ago, but basically it means that renowned EverQuest creator Brad McQuaid is not the father of an amazing high-quality fantasy MMO that's difficult as fuck.
When it comes to Baby Pantheon, Brad McQuaid, you are not the father.
It's sad, though, because, I mean, when you talked about it the other week, I didn't even look it up. I just took your word for it. But when I was preparing the news, I looked it up, and I'm reading about the game summary about, you know, group-oriented combat, the idea of focusing on preparation and awareness of what your skill sets are before going into a battle, as though you would have to pick and choose. I don't know. There's something about it that sounds much more interactive than most MMOs can be.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it just shows that not only is the genre on the decline, MMORPGs in general, but that EverQuest audience is just, it's not very big, it's not very powerful, and people just don't have the palate for that kind of game anymore. It's apparently, unlike all these other, you know, nostalgic reboots of adventure games and isometric RPGs and you know, starship simulators, that hardcore MMO seems to just be a genre that's dead and gone. And it's sad as fuck to me, because I think there's a place for that. I think it's really interesting. Some of my fondest memories of all time were a Brad McQuaid game, EverQuest, and I want it to still exist. Meanwhile, I didn't contribute, you know, to the Kickstarter, and I contribute to Kickstarters, but it was. I got the feeling, and this may be why it wasn't successful, that I just wasn't sure they could deliver, you know?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, you're talking about how the culture is a bit different, and I wonder if I don't know the word to use for this. I'm wondering if there's sort of this Facebookization going on within MMOs. In other words, there was a core audience, you know, for MMOs as well as with Facebook, right? Facebook was college students. Then it got bigger. The people playing it, the people using the service got bigger. All of a sudden, World of Warcraft became accessible to so many people that there was an expectation that it shouldn't be too hard because I need to get through this. You know, I have an expectation as a paying customer to make it through the levels. And, you know, I just pulled this up now. This wasn't even in my news, but I read it and I just thought about it. You can now buy a level 90 World of Warcraft character boost for $60 through Blizzard. And again, I think it's... And when I was trying to make the parallel with Facebook, it's like now a lot of the core users of Facebook are abandoning it because it's saturated or oversaturated with a market that wasn't there in the first place. And now that market has descended upon it and sullied it, and it's over. I don't know. For me, there's this Rise of the Fallen, or Pantheon Rise of the Fallen, was the answer to what we could jump to as MMO players, because honestly, I played Guild Wars 2, but I haven't even fired up a new game. And I was just talking to a good friend just last night who I used to play MMOs with, and he tried, I think, Neverwinter, which is free to play. And he was just telling me how it's lackluster. It's a clone of a lot of the stuff we've already seen. And he's yearning for the days when there was a thing like EverQuest that challenged you, and that there was actual circumstances and consequences to your actions.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I feel like EverQuest is a thing that will never happen again. It was a moment in time. It was a kind of design, a quirky sort of design that we don't have the tolerance or patience for anymore. And it was that punishing, awful design that made you love it in a way. It was like an abusive parent or something. It,
right.
Like it beat you down, but it was like it made you just attached to them in some perverse way. I have such, unlike any other game in my gaming history of 33 years, I have more memories and fondness for EverQuest than anything else. And it's sad to see that, you know, one of the lead designers of that game not even be able to kickstart a follow-up.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Last part of this segment, hot off the wire. I go into this with a heavy heart. Rest in peace, Brad McQuaid.
He just shot himself.
Hot off the wire, this is where we call the depths of the PR newswire, which, by the way, is very uneasy on the eyes, I must say. I mean, I got a headache from reading this shit, especially because it's just full of, like, just the most dull, boring press releases I've ever read in my
That's
life.
That's why I love it. It's where people who can't get press organically go as, like, some shot in the dark flare in the void of press. To like, well, we've got a press release out, you know?
Right. Well, so you told me the search terms and parameters of what I should be looking for when I search this. There's not a lot of gaming news going on right now. It's as usual, you talk about how there's a lot of casino gaming, so I had to, you know, breach through that first. Then there's a lot of stuff with regard to the Olympics right now, so I had to get around that. And I finally found a story that it actually kind of pissed me off in a way. I don't know why, but it links into Kickstarter, actually. So here's what it says. User interface software Dizmo smashes Kickstarter goal.
this is a whole subgenre of the PR Newswire is Kickstarter announcements.
See, I didn't know that. But this is the thing that stood out for me, because I could have told you about... what is it? Leapfrog Gaming or whatever they're called. Leapfrog has a shit ton of PR news announcements. Yeah. Every day there's a new Leapfrog. Hey, learning capabilities of kids went up. I don't know. But this one in particular, it was frustrating, especially after the whole Brad McQuaid debacle. So today, Dizmo, now this is a small caps D, so it's just D-I-Z-M-O, has smashed its goal on crowdfunding site Kickstarter with more than 2 weeks to go. Starting from $35, Dizmo is futuristic user interface software that allows you to interact with digital surfaces within the smart home. Smart home is capitalized.
What is this, like, the only time I've ever seen a smartphone was at Disneyland. No. Or smart home, I mean.
Okay. Yeah, that was the house of the future, yeah. Or whatever it is. Yeah, I've been there. Dizmo will now go into development. Now, keep in mind, I haven't told you what their goal was, by the way. This is crucial to the story. But Dizmo, because they met their goal, will now go into development of the product version of the software, which will be available from June this year. I'm reading directly from the copy here. The disruptive Dizmo software allows charts, images, websites, and videos to coexist and be moved, rotated, and interacted as though they were physical objects, meaning that you can visualize wireless devices, sensors, and controls in an intuitive way. Keep track of your favorite sports games, follow friends on social media, keep an eye on the security cameras while chatting to friends over a call, all on the same touchscreen.
I gotta step in here, Dizmo. I hate to break this to you. It's tough. I know you're really excited about your product. You're excited about meeting the Kickstarter goal, but there's this thing that's been out for a few years now that I own a lot. Millions and millions of people over the world own. It basically does all this. It's called an iPad. And I hate to break it to you. It already exists, Dizmo. I don't know what your funding goal is. I don't know what your ambitions are. Some kind of Minority Report gestural interface or something.
You just hit on the big... That's the buzzword, okay? Now, it's 2014. I think Minority Report came out in like 2005, 6, 7. I don't know. Some year back in the aughts. And Matthias... But he says his name stupidly. A.B., founder and CEO and CTO at Dizmo explains, quote, "We are absolutely astounded by the positive response we've had so far and that we hit our goals so quickly. Moreover, Kickstarter statistics tell us that today we are the most popular project on Earth among the 722 projects in our category. A massive thank you to everyone who has backed, supported, and given us your feedback. We could not have done it without you. With our backers, we can now develop technology for the 21st century as part of the smart home and Internet of Things," that's all in caps, "meaning that software can keep up with the rapidly progressing hardware market." Here's how they describe their technology. Their futuristic software can be correlated with the things that you might have seen in pop culture, such as stuff on CSI, Iron Man, Minority Report, yep, and 2001: A Space Odyssey. Okay, so before I even tell you the project funding goals, I just want to... I Googled this. May 29th, 2007, Microsoft debuts Minority Report-like Surface computer, i.e. Microsoft Surface. If you know what that is, it exists. We have it. Yeah. It's in existence. Okay, Microsoft has the backing of zillions of dollars in capital. Dizmo reached their goal of their... They got 298 backers on Kickstarter. They're pledged... Wait, Tanner, predict what their... Tell me what you think their goal was. I mean, for software like this, one thing that they talk about is that their UI gives you unlimited access. So in other words, as you swipe through stuff, it's an unlimited thing. It's like Microsoft Excel, you get to row 22,000 and you're like, when does this end? That's what this does.
Well, if you consider... An MMO wanted $800,000, and this is claiming to be a complete revolution of gestural interface operating system design.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You'd figure it's got to be in the millions, right?
That's what you'd figure. Now subtract about $980 million from that. Pledged
$25,000 goal. They totally beat that goal by $1,459. They have a total of $26,459 to develop the world's most revolutionary versatile UI system.
For the
oh boy,
for the cost of a line cook at Arby's, you get a complete computing revolution.
To be fair to that line cook, he probably works overtime. Yeah. So that's how he gets that. This, I watched their demo. I was watching all that, and then I was like, I swear this exists. You know, this Minority Report style technology, it exists already. I mean, not in the way that you see where, like, Tom Cruise is, you know, pulling and popping shit out of, you know, the ether in front of him. But, like, this stuff happens on tabletops or projected onto a wall or whatever it is. This is nothing new. And yet these people are claiming that it's the most popular project on Earth among the other 722 Kickstarters trying to do the same thing. Are the other Kickstarters involved only asking for $10,000 as a goal? I'm trying to figure this out. Can we get in on this game? Can we do a Super Dumb Games, you know, versatile UI that allows you to touch a surface and shuffle shit? I'm befuddled.
Welcome to the...
What do you have to say?
Welcome to the PR Newswire.
And that is your news. Urban legends are all pervasive. I think that they span pretty much almost all facets of our life. I mean, I can think back to with Halloween, there was always the urban legend of the 30-story haunted house or whatever it was, 12 stories, and you make it to the top and you get your reward, that kind of thing. But it's interesting when it happens within games. And earlier I sort of mentioned the fact that there was always some kid who claimed that they could shoot the dog in Duck Hunt. And it was never somebody you knew. It was always a friend of a friend. And I was recently sent a story by one of our most rabid fans to the point of fanaticism, Endless Analingus. I've invited him into my home. Maybe that was a mistake. I'm not sure now. But he sent over a story about some of the creepiest urban legends in the history of gaming. Now, before I go into some of those, because some of them actually aren't that creepy when I look at them. Some of them are just stupid, honestly. because it requires a set of beliefs that make you gullible. So it's dumb. But before I go into that, Tanner, is there any kind of like an urban legend that, or a mystique that surrounded a game that either utterly baffled you or you just took it at face value and you thought, yeah, that must be true. I mean, that must have happened to a gamer playing the game or within a game somehow.
Yeah, just hold on a second.
Sounds like you just opened an ice cold Coors.
New show meme. So, continuing on with the EverQuest talk, the thing that really sticks out to me is an EverQuest myth that turned out to be true.
Whoa.
So, and I don't remember the exact timeline of this. Maybe friend of the show Eric can clarify. But I recall in EverQuest, there was rumors of a sea monster in the sea. And you would travel on a boat, and you were kind of locked on this boat that would go through this set animation, which was basically a loading screen, essentially, to get you to a different area. And people would say that there was a monster in that ocean that every now and then someone would see. And it was never really verified. And of course, there were a lot of websites that would, you know, kind of crowdsourced bestiaries in a way that would take screenshots of mobs and, you know, talk about their stats and what loot they dropped. And there was always rumors of this monster, but no one ever got a screenshot of it. And then I think it was with the Ruins of Kunark expansion. I think what happened was the developers knew about this myth.
Oh.
And they made the myth reality. So in the Timorous Deep, there was this rare spawn. And this was one of the wonderful things about EverQuest was there were spawns. You know, there was one instance of this thing that if you weren't there, you wouldn't see it. And it was on some mysterious clock that, you know, could be days and days before you'd actually see this thing appear. And there were theories about how you'd get it to appear. Well, you kill this thing, then you run over here, kill this thing. Well, there was a sea monster in the Timorous Deep that would appear every now and again. It was this rare spawn thing. And it was just one of those things that, you know, I loved that they took something that was myth and made it reality and but still preserved a lot of the mystery and wonder of it, because I never saw it in person. But you knew the possibility was there. And I remember as well, they had a unicorn that was super rare, maybe would spawn every week or so. And I would look at screenshots of it, and every time I would go through that forest that unicorn would spawn in, I would kind of look around, you know, and I'd be aware, like hoping that I would see it. And I never did, of course, but the knowledge that potentially it was there made the game so much more magical.
And see, with games like that, though, because in that moment, I'm guessing you were alone in the forest looking for a unicorn. Yeah. And that can be so immersive and scary if you're alone in a dark room and you're just looking for this one thing. You know, you're not on a boat looking for the sea monster. In fact, I think I remember that tale being told about there being this monster out there while being on the boat. But with the unicorn thing, that would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, it was. And you'd start seeing things. You know, I was often playing at night, had some music on, some Typo Negative.
Of course.
You know, and you'd start, like, you wanted it to happen so badly and there wouldn't be anyone around. And you'd think you saw a flash of white or something. And it never was.
Something analog to that, but far more frivolous, I suppose, was, I don't know if you remember this. And you can tell me if it's true, because I don't know if it's true or not. If you remember in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, there was this urban legend that there was a Bigfoot lurking in the forests of the hills of around San Andreas. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and it is... It's one of the most notorious urban legends around games that Rockstar's actually played into, and they'll put Sasquatches in little iconography, you know, maybe like you'll see a patch and it'll be on it or whatever.
Right.
But I think as far as anyone can tell, it's not something that's ever been in the game, but of course people have photoshopped pictures of it, but it doesn't exist.
So I was provided this list. If I can, for a moment, reach into the community bin. There was 10 games given on this list. Some of them are just dumb. For instance, let me look. Lavender Town Syndrome. Back in 1996, the Pokemon Red and Green video games delighted Game Boy owners all over the world. I've already cashed out after that sentence. Midway through it, when they said Pokemon, I was done. But they talk about this one part which had to do with, it said that the game was first released in Japan and it supposedly correlated with a huge spike in suicides and illness in children ranging in age from 7 to 12. The children did not fall ill or commit suicide until reaching Lavender Town in the popular game. The game's score was said to be the source of the sinister ailments in children. The piercing tones of the music caused headaches, nausea, and eventually suicidal tendencies in young children. The music in the level was changed before the game was shipped overseas. Thank God Japan noticed that there was a problem with this, and they did not infect North America or Europe before this happened.
Love it.
Yeah, I mean, and then they show a clip. I'm not even going to entertain watching the clip, because I don't think there is a correlation between music in a game or talking to a character in a game and the person's death. But most of this list does have a correlation with that sort of shit. One of the more interesting ones, though, was about predicting the future. Now, we all know who Nostradamus was. He was bullshit. But if you lived in the 90s like the rest of us did, you lived in fear of Nostradamus's predictions, because every week, I believe on Fox 2 or whatever the channel was, there was a show called Ancient Prophecies. Do you remember that?
It was like every fucking week.
Yeah. You know, for whatever reason, in the 90s, Nostradamus was like almost the most popular person in the world next to like Zach Morris and Terrence Trent D'Arby.
He was almost declared man of the year, even though he had been dead for centuries. But there is this idea that Fallout 3 predicts the future. Because, look, we're dealing with an open world simulation of what happens in a post-nuclear world. You know, the Chinese have invaded us. What do we do, right? Well, according to this website, and I'm reading verbatim from the website, so this is a quote. The story goes that the post-apocalyptic game predicts the future in the real world using Morse code and hidden messages within the game's radio station. There are stations that broadcast Morse code in the game. However, some claim that you can hear a DJ on the station rambling off such cryptic phrases as, "The queen has died today. The world mourns. As on days like these, we are all Brits." And, quote, "I can't believe Britney's actually won an Oscar." These phrases are followed by a series of numbers in Morse code that can be interpreted as dates. Whether or not the queen will die on March 19th, 2014, that's like a few weeks from now, remains to be seen. Bethesda, the company that designed the game, denies that these cryptic radio stations exist. Did you get a chill in your spine when I read that, though? March 19th is just, like, it's like 3 weeks away.
I love that there are people in the world who believe that somehow the developers of Fallout 3 are part of this mysterious Metal Gear-like shadow cabinet that influences world affairs. And not only that, announces it years prior.
Right.
Like setting up their own smoking gun to convict them.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's like the Obama being like somehow hoisted upon us as president, as though the conspiracy began at the date of his birth, like he knew what he was doing when he was 0 years old. It's ridiculous shit.
If I was the queen and I heard about this, I would just croak myself. Just to fuel conspiracy theorists just to blow their fucking minds.
Just strap a belt around your throat, swap that 90-year-old minge.
Just pull a David.
That's right.
David Carradine. It's,
that's right.
Just fiddle with your bean.
Fiddle with the fudge. Hey! Hey, you played Majora's Mask, right?
No.
Oh. Well, then I'm going to skip that one. Well, there's. All right, so apparently when you start the game, somebody noticed that there was already a game saved on the cartridge simply titled Ben. He ignored the save file and started a new game and noticed that all the NPCs, the non-playable characters, would refer to him as Ben. He deleted the Ben file and tried to start a new game. The game became more erratic. The music would play backwards and his character began to be followed by a statue of the game's main character with a creepy smile on his face. Eventually, the Ben file returned to the game. Along with it was another new file simply entitled Drowned. Every time he played after the two files appeared, his character would simply die and creepy messages would sprawl across the screen saying, "You've met with a terrible fate, haven't you?" It's so dumb.
The story ends there because the guy couldn't investigate any further because he was too busy furiously masturbating.
So this next one, I think I'm going to read like three more tops because I don't really give a shit. Honestly, they're all dumb. But this one is interesting because it's something that somebody in the modding community could easily introduce into a mod. So we all know Morrowind, The Elder Scrolls 3 was
one of the best games of all time.
Yeah, one of the most amazing games of all time. And it's because of the modding community that it is one of the best games. So apparently there's a mod that popped up on the internet a couple of years ago, and when you would install it, people thought it was a virus, because when you loaded that game, it would freeze at the title screen, all of your saved games were corrupted, and you couldn't play the game, technically. But
sounds like a virus.
Yeah. However,
it checks out.
Yeah. However, this is from the article.
It deletes all your save files, freezes the game. and then scrolls across your screen in like early 90s screensaver style, you've contracted a fucking virus.
I still have, dude, I have dreams about viruses on a computer. Like, I'll have nightmares that involve getting a virus on a computer, and it's the worst.
I had the best virus ever, but it, another time to okay. describe it. It was called the Elvira virus. All Caps fans probably remember that.
So, here's what would happen, though, all right? It would corrupt your save game files and all this other stuff, but it was soon discovered, and I'm reading this from the site, that if you ran the game in DOSBox, software that allows gamers to play older PC games on their modern computers, the game would work. When the player starts the game with a mod, all the main characters in the game are already dead. Also,
I love the phrasing "already dead." Yeah. as if their death was imminent because yeah. you were going to kill them.
That's right. Also, if you stay in one spot for too long, your health would slowly begin to deplete. If you died from standing still too long, a new character would reveal himself. Players took to calling him the Assassin. He appeared to be a man, except his legs and arms were long and bent like a spider. Players began to notice that if you paid close attention, the player could see the assassin around corners or scurrying up the walls, but only for brief moments. Another creepy element added to the game was all the characters left living would come outside at night and just stand there. When a player would attempt to interact with one of the characters, they would simply say, "Watch the sky." A new dungeon was also discovered. Inside that dungeon was what players called the Hall of Portraits. The hall was lined with picture frames inside the frames. Go ahead.
I already know about this. What was really extraordinary about it was you went into the dungeon. All the portraits were glamour shots of all the NPCs.
They had collars popped.
Yeah, hair teased.
So much Aquanet in that curl. It says, at the end of... Oh, and it said, inside the frames were photos from the player's My Pictures folder. So if you put all of your fat pictures in there, there's a ton of nudes on the wall. At the end of the hall was a locked door. No one has ever posted proof that they figured out how to open the door. Again, this goes back to, you know, friend of a friend says that they might have done it, but nobody we know has actually done it. But there are some unbelievable stories of players obsessed with trying to open it, playing the modded game for days straight with very little sleep. Some claim, after long hours of playing, they began to hallucinate, seeing the assassin in real life quickly crawling on their bedroom ceilings or down their hallways as they took a bathroom break from the game.
What? That sounds very specific.
Yeah. I gotta take a piss. Ow! He's on the wall! As fantastic as the story sounds, the creepiest part is that this mod does in fact seem to exist, but download it at your own risk. I will tell you the name of the mod. It is Morrowind Mod, all lowercase, JVK1166Z.esp. Get it.
I'm intrigued. I mean, this is... I don't want to risk my computer, which is my work computer, mm-hmm. but one of our legions of Super Dumb Games fans should risk this.
I would love to see that happen.
And record what the fuck happens.
The last one I want to talk about, you know, again, I'm skipping through these, but this is one that I think is actually really, well, I'm not saying it's plausible. I'm just saying that I'm saying it could have happened. So number one on this list is the legend of Polybius, and they say that it's likely the oldest gaming myth and had the honor of guest starring in an episode of The Simpsons. Polybius was an arcade game that mysteriously appeared in an arcade in Portland, Oregon in the early 1980s. The cabinet was completely black except for the green joysticks and the logo at the top of the machine. The game combined elements of classic shooters like Tempest, mazes like in Pac-Man, and spatial puzzles. When played, it supposedly caused all sorts of health problems, including amnesia, blackouts, nausea, seizures, headaches, night terrors, and, in some cases, players were reported to commit suicide not long after playing.
And they contracted unbearable dick weight.
That's just a legion of dick weight. It is also said that men dressed in all black would often be seen messing with the game, leading some to speculate that the device was not a video game, but a government experiment. Whether or not this insidious arcane game ever existed is actually not known. Here's my theory on this. Back in the 80s, there were, just like in the 70s, there was an insane amount of paranoia about satanic cults and whatnot. And I think this is the kind of myth that would be spread very quickly where, you know, men in black are operating a game system. And I think that there's a bit of license taken here when they think that it's a government experiment. I have a feeling that there was probably a rumor that it was like Satanists who were trying to indoctrinate people or kill people or whatever it is. That's such a 70s and 80s mentality to have where, you know, a game would be so nefarious as to cause these ailments in you, and then the people who come in to like repair it or collect the coins, because let's not forget there is a owner of an arcade who would have to look at that machine every day and go, I should probably take out the quarters in that. Nope, the men in black do that.
I love it. I mean, I feel like games in particular engender this kind of thing. Yeah, because they're like these mysterious mechanical systems that could potentially, you know, when you watch a movie, there aren't many mysteries to be had. You know, mm-hmm. You can interpret it in different ways, but everyone's kind of seeing the same stuff. But with games, there's this feeling that different people could uncover different things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that makes games amazing and wonderful and why we all love them.
I think also there's that element of, because we didn't design it, we don't know about it. And it's the same as how my parents view email. You know, it's this thing that exists. And when something comes into their inbox, they get scared about what's happening because it's just the unknown. They don't know anything more about it. So I don't know. I mean, I think that wraps up this episode, right? That's 21 episodes in the bag. This one being double the size of most episodes.
And our final episode. So thank you, everyone.
Oh, what a swan song to sing. We've been floating in the pond too long. I mean, we already, I think in episode 4, the commissioner of all podcasts called us and told us we were the best. So
yeah, there was nowhere else to go. It was kind of disappointing. Yeah,
it's very upsetting. But check us out again, I guess, in episode 22, where we talk about more dumb baseball games I played on Nintendo. I don't know. Who knows what episode 22 will hold?
And we spice things up by adding a precocious 7-year-old who's like our love child.
The Ted McGinley of the show. Also look forward to the fact that it will contain a virus that will infect your computer and make you believe that there's some urban legend like occurrence happening.
Anyway, superdumbgames.com, rate and review us on iTunes. Let me know what's best for all of you in terms of a Dark Souls 2 stream.
All right, check us out.
Dumb games.